meetings for Monday, June 13th. I would like to have Mr. Honeycutt, Mr. Klein, Mr. Shetterly, and Bob, would you come up, please, to the four seats here? And committee, we're going to start with section four, but first, as we have discussed, I would like to move the dash ones into 3120 to give us a framework in that the amended dash three amendments are not ready yet. So this will give us a body to begin to amend to when we get the dash three's amendment. So I would look for a motion to chair.
I move the dash one amendments into House Bill 3120.
Representative Anderson has moved the dash ones into House Bill 3120. Any discussion?
Chair?
I just want to say that there are so many amendments that I will agree to this today, but I am very reluctant to accept that.
Okay, I understand that. Representative
Nolan. Mr. Chair, I will also support this motion because I think it puts a stake in the ground for us. And out of respect for all the work you have done trying to identify the issues and sort them out, and also understanding from what you have said that this is an attempt to have a bill that actually relates to Measure 37, which we currently don't have in House Bill 3120, and understanding that this will not be the final motion on this bill, but there will be subsequent amendments. I think it's an astute move to have us have something to work from.
Thank you, Representative. Any other comments? Representative Ackerman.
I apologize for being late. Could you repeat the motion?
The motion was simply to move the dash ones into House Bill 3120 to, as I think Representative Nolan accurately described, drive a stake in the ground from which we can begin to move the dash threes, which still have to be, many of them, amended. So therefore, we have something to move something into.
Mm-hmm. It was a dash one, the one that you submitted.
The dash one was my original draft.
Yes. Okay.
Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Greenland.
I assume we're gutting what's in 3120, is that correct?
Yes, and that's also part of the reason that it gives us a Rule 37 bill to amend.
The motion would be to gut what's in 3120 and amend into it. 3120-1.
Dash one amendment.
Mr. Chair, the dash one amendment does the gutting, I believe.
Oh, yes, it does. You're absolutely right.
Yes, last week we were using the replaced dash six amendments as a framework to go forward. Now, are we going to have trouble meshing those into the dash ones in terms of what changes that we had identified last week?
Do we not anticipate that? We will continue working with those dash sixes to move them into 3120.
Thank you.
We're just giving ourselves a little bit of framework to build on. Any further discussion?
No. Mr. Chair, let's make sure.
Okay.
There is a question as to whether the dash one amendment deletes all the body of the current 3120. And not having the original bill in front of me.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. For the record, Wayne Shetterly, Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. Just so to assist the committee on this, the dash one amendments amend House Bill 3120. They do not gut House Bill 3120. If you look on line 10 of the dash one amendments, you delete line 27 and page 2, which is just over the applicability section. But otherwise, the substance of House Bill 3120 remains under the dash one amendments. Just see.
But the intention is to delete all of it. Is that right, the current on it?
Yes.
It's not applicable by this committee.
I think that's what the motion should say.
That would be a conceptual amendment.
We could go on record as
much as we can. We don't have to. Maybe it would just be better to not
just move it, and then we can always, we're going to have at least one more amendment.
That'll be our first amendment.
Gotcha.
Okay, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Ashman?
Aye.
Representative Freeman?
Aye.
Representative Nolan?
Yes.
Representative Anderson?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative McDonald?
Aye.
Chair Gerard?
The chair votes aye. So the dash one amendments are moved into 3120. Gentlemen, we were at the dash four, or excuse me, section four of what was the amendments to the dash threes, correct?
We're working from the June 8th document.
The document dated June 8th, yes.
I think they were beyond that. I think they were just concluded the claims process.
About 15 or something.
About page 13, I think, stopped right at the judicial review part, I believe.
I don't think we went through section 4. But we did approve the claims process, which were sections 5, section 6.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. We've approved all these things as we've gone?
No, we haven't approved anything.
No.
I'm sorry.
We
have verbally, in our minds, conceptually approved. And, gosh, I'm sorry, I see my note now. We start on section 8.
Mm-hmm.
Section 8. So,
Mr. Chair, just to be clear.
We have not approved anything at this point.
We understand them best a human can understand a
hopefully tomorrow we will begin to do that. Representative Ackerman.
We did identify some concerns, and I assume we kept a list of those. If we go back, we can address them.
This will be the first round, and then tomorrow morning, we will not meet this evening. Tomorrow morning, we will go through with round two and actually begin to move the amendments into 3120. Tomorrow morning and tomorrow afternoon.
That wasn't quite my point. We identified several things in the draft and replaced dash six. There were items of concern, but I don't think that we have amendments drafted. How do we incorporate those or get votes on those? We have two separate amendments, or are we going to do one on
the We'll have to do the amendments and then bring them. And that's why we kind of slowed down the process a little bit, in that it may be Thursday night before we are able to move the final product out. But I certainly would advise our committee members, if you have proposed amendments, that you have them ready. And then we'll consider them as they become available to us.
I didn't know if we would do that individually or do that as we, more or less as a group process as we went through. And
I would prefer that we do that as a group process.
Amendment on the trust being identified as an owner, what have you. Do you want me to submit a separate amendment to that, or should we discuss that when we're through going through the entire packet?
Hopefully we can do that this afternoon and give you authorization to have that drafted and done.
Okay, thank you.
And any other amendments that you feel, because I know there were several several areas that you had concerns, so we can give the committee attentions the first priority in doing.
Anybody keep track of those concerns last week, so we have sort of a list of work on them?
I have some of them. I had, there was a question that you postponed, had to do with the Family Trust LLC, and you wanted to revisit that on Monday. There was another question a couple times, I guess, trust came up. There were some questions that the work panel, I think in section 4, that they wanted to kind of give some time to kind of work out themselves. I think you had a number of questions relative to trust, family trust, and along those lines that they want. They requested some additional time, I think, over the weekend to kind of clarify some of the definitions and thoughts. So several of your questions that came up on Friday were basically along the same theme, and I think that's best in ownership and those topics in that general category.
As long as there's a place to recap these and get, you know, the direction as to who's going to submit the amendments. That's all I'm concerned
about. Yeah, I don't think you gave any specific direction on those. It was something you want to talk about. And a second one that was a large area of your time that you talked about last Friday had to do with the date. There was a March 15th date that old Measure 37 claims and essentially what was called new Measure 37 claims. The group, the committee had some discussion over, but no direction relative to that date. So that was, again, something that you decided you wanted to postpone to a later time.
Actually, the discussion wasn't the date, about the date. I mean, that was the minor issue. The major issue was whether there's an old Measure 37 and a new Measure 37.
That's what was under the agreement is correct. That was the real discussion on that issue. While we're in the judicial, Mr. Miller, would you come up? Mr. Hendricott's out of the room for a moment, so we might have you lead off because you had some what I felt were informative suggestions to make this whole thing work easier. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bruce Miller, Assistant Staff Counsel for the Office of the State Court Administrator. And the document I'm referring to is the June 8, 2005 proposed amendments to House Bill 3120, which is the one that you worked off of last go-around here. Mr. Klein and I have discussed these points. He's working to get them incorporated into the next version of this, but I thought I'd take a moment and bring you up to speed on a couple of the issues that we saw in this. Once again, the Judicial Department isn't taking a position on the important policy issues in front of you, but we are looking at some of the procedural aspects to see if we can smooth out the rough edges a little bit. The first point I wanted to bring up was in Section 8.1, and this is an issue that I brought to you before about exclusive jurisdiction. And if you remember in this document, in the June 8th document, there's a section 7.3b that where an owner can file a claim along with a land use application, and the appeals process for that goes through LUBA. And so if we go to Section 8.1, which talks about circuit court having exclusive jurisdiction, you'll want to consider having a reference in there saying except for in the case of Section 7.3b, so there isn't a conflict between the jurisdictions for those two situations. And if you'd like, Mr. Chair, I can stop after each one of these in case someone has a question.
Yeah, it took us just a moment to make sure we were on the right spot with Bruce. So if you would reiterate that again,
sure.
The committee, I think we'd be helpful.
If we look at, I'll start with Section 8.1. It says the circuit court has exclusive jurisdiction. Except that's not necessarily true under this bill, because if we go to Section 7.3b, there's a process where an owner can file both a claim, a Measure 37 claim, and a land use application. In that instance, appeal goes to LUBA. So jurisdiction isn't exclusive in circuit court because in that one instance it goes to LUBA, and we just need a cross-reference so that there isn't a conflict between those two.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Greenlee.
I see the circuit court has exclusive jurisdiction. Does that mean final jurisdiction?
Representative Greenlee, I don't believe it does, especially since there is a specific section in this draft that says that appeals go to the Court of Appeals after circuit court process.
I wonder what exclusive means in that context.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, I can't answer that because I didn't draft it, although I have some ideas, but perhaps Mr. Klein has some ideas.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, if you'd like, I can answer that question.
Please.
For the record, Glenn Klein with Harang Long. Exclusive jurisdiction in this case means that it would be the circuit court rather than LUBA and rather than the Court of Appeals and rather than the tax court that would hear the matter initially when it gets on review from the local or state government. For example, the Administrative Procedures Act says that the Court of Appeals has exclusive jurisdiction over a matter that arises out of a contested case before a state agency. The statutes say that the tax court has exclusive jurisdiction over matters coming out of the Department of Revenue. It doesn't mean it's the final decision, that it's not subject to appeal. It just means that when it gets to the next level into court, that review is in circuit court as opposed to LUBA or the Court of Appeals or the tax court.
This is a term of art in statute then?
That's correct, Representative Greenwood.
It means exclusive initial?
It means exclusive as the initial place where the review is. It doesn't mean final in the sense that there is no appeal. And as Mr. Miller said, Section 11 of this makes that, if there's any question, makes it explicit. Section 11 says appeals of final judgment entered in the circuit court get heard by the Court of Appeals. But it is a term of art in the statutes.
Thank you. So, Mr. Klein, you're agreeing with Mr. Miller that we need to insert in 8-1.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. In fact, when Mr. Miller went over each of his suggestions to me, I agreed with each of them and have been in the process of trying to draft things.
Okay, great. So this is much more of an informational thing as far as the committee is concerned. We're sitting here trying to make notes, legal wording, and that kind of thing. So that's very helpful to know. Thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that was sort of my intent here, was just that you would understand what happens between the drafts when you see them, and also to get our concerns on the
record. That's fine. Thank you, and please continue.
Thank you. Another item that Mr. Klein and I had discussed.
This is under Ackerman.
While we're on Section 1, I didn't understand the second sentence where it says, notwithstanding the previous sentence, Circuit Court shall not have jurisdiction over claims relief created by a city or county ordinance related to a waiver approved by a public entity. I just lost that.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Ackerman, in fact, that was going to be my next point. I was lost on that one as well. I talked to Mr. Klein about it. He explained it to me, and I'm sure he can explain it to you. I'm not sure that sentence is where it needs to be yet, but he can tell you what it means.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, there was a concern raised that cities and counties should not adopt ordinances that would allow, in essence, a neighbor to sue a neighbor if, I file my claim, I get a waiver, and the result of that waiver reduces the fair market value of my neighbor's property. Some local governments have adopted ordinances that would allow my neighbor to sue me if the waiver, in essence, reduced the value of their property. What this sentence is intended to do is to say that if such an ordinance is adopted, that the circuit court would not be the place where that claim for relief could be heard. There's a Court of Appeals case that has said that the circuit courts can hear claims for relief that are created by cities or counties. This sentence is intended to say, notwithstanding that Court of Appeals decision, that at least for these kinds of claims, that the circuit court could not hear such a claim. There's other ways to draft this. One of them would be as an outright preemption, saying that a city or a county shall not adopt an ordinance that would authorize something like this. Those of us on the local government side of the work group had a concern about the legislature preempting us, and so instead what we tried to do is focus this language on the legislature telling circuit courts, in essence arms of the state, that they shall not hear these cases, in which case the cases might be able to be heard by municipal court.
Then who hears the cases?
In the case of a city, it would be a municipal court could hear the case, if there was a municipal court.
I'm not following that.
Why would you do this?
Why not go to circuit court? It has greater powers, I think.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, originally the reason why local governments, I believe, said these should be heard in circuit court or created the causes of action to be heard in circuit court is because that seemed to be the best place for them to be heard. But a member of the work group said they didn't like those causes of action. They didn't want them to be heard in circuit court, and this was one of those places where, as throughout the bill, there were gives and takes, and in order to try to get the bill agreed to by the work group, the local government said, okay, we can live with a slight preemption that simply says the circuit court won't be the place to hear this kind of claim for relief. But if the jurisdiction has the ability to empower the municipal court to hear that claim for relief, then the jurisdiction could still do it.
But the municipal court has limited geographic grounds, so what happens if a person had a claim that was in the county? You're basically saying they can't go to municipal court, but it doesn't make any difference. They can't go there anyway, maybe. So then what happens?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, in that case, the county would not be able to adopt such a third-party cause of action.
Why not just state it that way, that they, there's no claim for relief is allowed for third parties challenging, that would be subject to the waiver process that is initiated by another party? Why not just put it that way instead of putting it into such a court of such limited jurisdiction that it really has no real effect?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, the reason for the way it's written is because some cities do have the power to authorize their municipal courts to do it, and what we, the city folks, as part of this work group wanted to do was to preserve that home rule authority. That's why it wasn't written as an outright preemption. Certainly the legislature could write it and could change it to say that no county shall adopt this kind of cause of action.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a cleaner way to do it, but that leaves open the question as to whether, if a city did it, could it be heard in circuit court?
And just for the record, what are the jurisdictional limits of Eugene Municipal Court in relationship to Lane County Circuit Court? I'm trying to see how much you've limited the remedy if it's a damage claim.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, I'd be better if I got you something in writing on that. I'm just not clear enough as to what those are.
Okay. One last question on this one. Does the municipal court have injunctive powers? Can it issue an injunction?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, let me address that in the written memo as well.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenlee.
I mean, this is clearly a policy decision buried in a bunch of words that are unintelligible. So and this is a critical policy decision, so it is one that I think we need up front, and we need to decide it, not under here, not in this section, but somewhere else, clearly. I wonder if there are any other major policy decisions hidden in words like this throughout the document that compromise led you to obfuscate rather than to make clear.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, there were hundreds of conversations that went into trying to craft this 26-page piece of legislation. A lot of those involved give and take. Some of them were what we considered to be technical. Some of them were significant policy discussions. As to what's a matter of policy and what's technical, that's often in the eye of the beholder. There was no goal on anyone's part, of any member of the committee, to try to obfuscate anything. The difficulty here is that in trying to keep this bill as short as possible, as clear as possible, as comprehensive as possible, we chose words that we thought were clear. Now this one, this sentence, which didn't come up until last week in the work group, didn't succeed in accomplishing those objectives because, with perhaps the exception of two or three of us, nobody who has read it understands. And so I acknowledge that the sentence hasn't accomplished that purpose. But there aren't any, we didn't choose words in order to obfuscate, and I would be happy, and I'm pretty sure that Lane and Dave would be happy, as you go through this, to go through each paragraph and say, here's what's embedded in there. But that will require a much longer conversation than if I said Section 1 of this deals with the jurisdiction of the circuit court, Section 2 deals with who can file claims. If that's all I say, then there are going to be some things that are embedded in here that I wouldn't say. And so it's just a question of how much detail, how much talking you'd like me to do, or Lane to do, or Dave to do, or Bob to do. But yes, there are lots of things embedded in here.
I can follow that. I think if there are policy issues embedded, it would be worth taking the time to note them. I mean, saying that this was simply about circuit court jurisdiction would miss what is a significant policy issue. Can cities create ordinances that allow neighbors to have relief against neighbors who get Measure 37 claims is one that's being debated highly. So I think as a matter of personal privilege to me, it would be very helpful if there are policy decisions we come to that we do point them out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of things on that point. When I got an object lesson in how fraught with policy any cleanup is when I set out to clean out a garage for the first time in a year or two here in the last couple of weeks, where every decision about this old set of roller blades or this garden utensil became all of a sudden hot with policy when I thought I was just cleaning up.
That's your wife, right?
That's it, and my joke. So I think in fairness, I think you have to anticipate that there is policy galore in this language here. The decisions were made that have policy implications. As to this one specifically, I will say that the department, we didn't weigh in, and if this helps the committee at all, maybe it doesn't, but it's our position that on advice of counsel, that both under state law and under common law, neighbors have these causes of action already, whether they're created specifically by a local jurisdiction or not. So, again, if that helps the committee on the substantive issue, I don't know, but it was our position that you don't need a city ordinance to create a right that it exists already in the law if one exists.
And under this paragraph as it's written, where would that common law claim be taken? Would it be taken to a circuit court?
That's correct. It would be taken.
This wouldn't exclude that common law.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wheeler, no, this only excludes an action that would be based on a particular city or county ordinance that purports to create, by ordinance, a new private cause of action. Actions that are already available under state law or the common law would not be disallowed under this language. That's why we didn't take a strong position on this. These are local ordinance issues.
Representative Nola.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Seems to me then that this language probably ought to come out. It's designed to make it more difficult for a city or county that's trying to help some aggrieved parties, and ends up, from what you've just said, Mr. Shetterly, a city or county that wants to do that is precluded from doing it unless it has a municipal court, but a city or county that doesn't pass such an ordinance does not hinder its citizens. So by being proactive, the city essentially hurts its citizens by taking away its access to the circuit court, but by being silent, a city leaves its citizens with the same protections that it already has. If our standard here, Mr. Chair, is simple and relatively non-controversial, I don't think that this one hits that standard.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, without commenting on your last observation, I don't think that I wouldn't agree that a city that has adopted an ordinance has harmed what it would have caused harm to its citizens on account of this language. It would simply leave them in the same place as a city that hadn't adopted an ordinance. They wouldn't have a specific right of action based on ordinance 70.330, which may include in some cities the ability to recover attorney fees that may not be available at state law. They wouldn't have those special ordinance-based rights, but they would still have whatever general state law and common law rights any other citizen would have in a circuit court action.
All the legal beagles agree to that. And maybe we can't resolve that here. Mr. Klein has offered to draft a memo on this. I'd like to have Mr. Miller or the Department of Justice look at it. and make sure that all the legal beagles, including maybe our own, but I am hesitant to volunteer him for any more service, take a look at it. We probably can't resolve it here today.
Mr. Chair, if I can add one more thing. In terms of the policy question for you, the question is, does the legislature wish to preempt a local government from doing something in this area? If you take out the sentence, there's nothing in Measure 37 that preempts a local government. There's nothing in Measure 37 that speaks to whether a local government can do this. So if you put something into the measure, into what you adopt, like this sentence, then what you have decided to do is take power away from local governments. If you don't want to do anything related to this, then you just take it out. This sentence would not authorize, it would not give any more power to a local government than the local government currently has. What it does is to take power away from the local government. So the question for you, from a policy perspective, is do you want to preempt home rule cities and counties from doing something related to this? And if you do, then you include something, and if you don't, then you don't include the sentence.
Okay. And we can further complicate it by just comparing counties and cities, and you know what you may want to. Multnomah County has a tendency to frighten members of this committee with their land use decision. But on the other hand, other counties throughout the state, you know, we have a little more trust in, shall we say. So it's really a tough call in that respect.
For the record, I'm not sure that I want to be noted as being frightened by Multnomah County's
I got that from somebody.
I'm sometimes surprised.
I think Dorothy English told me that. I'm not quite sure, but
she didn't seem very frightened either.
I'm no match for you today. Okay. Bruce, go ahead and continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move on now, staying in Section 8 to subparagraphs 7 and 8 on page 14 of
coming back to some of these others.
You certainly will. Okay.
Those two subsections, 7 and 8, deal with the scope of judicial review. I've read these several times, and I keep going back and forth on whether they are inconsistent and perhaps somewhat redundant. Mr. Klein has shown me some of the work that he's done on that, and I think it helps. And hopefully you'll see that in the LC draft that comes out. But I just raise that as you look at those two sections to try to decide if they match up. I think you can argue either way. Moving on to, excuse me, I'll wait in case there are any questions.
Are you still on Section 8? Because I have some questions, and I'll wait until you're through in case I have the state preempt here.
I'll stay on 8.
Do you want me to go, or do you want to finish 8?
I'm done with 8.
You're done on 8. Okay, I have a couple of questions. As I read Section 8.2, the owner has an appeal.
8.2?
Section 8, sub 2.
He's on sub 8.2. We said it was coming back to those. Is that right? That's what the chair said. These are just particular. Is that right, Mr. Chair?
I'm sorry.
We are coming back to earlier items in Section 8.
Absolutely. We're going to go through first to see what's easy to do, and then we go back a second time to pick and choose.
How far you're going to go.
If you'd like to do it now, do it now.
Well,
are you going to be here for... Well, I think we should just get rid of Section 8 if you want to. Okay. I think that's the direct way of doing it.
Okay.
Section 8.2 allows an appeal by the owner and others that have participated in the hearing. Each may, therefore, I think, seek judicial review. The non-owners were also granted intervention rights in Section 8.3. What was the rationale to allow the others that participate in the hearing basically to get into court in two ways? Should we limit them to a direct appeal, even though the case doesn't affect them, or should we limit them to a
intervention, or does it make any difference?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, I suppose I should make this clear. I was not involved in the drafting of this document. I have directed some, raised some issues with Mr. Klein, but I suspect that those types of questions are probably better put to the work group and Mr. Klein, since they know where they were headed with this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, what subsection 2 will do, as you point out, it allows a person, it certainly allows the claimant to file an appeal, but it will also allow any other person who had participated in the government's decision or in the government's proceeding, and who is adversely affected, which is a term of art that the appellate courts have described in detail as to what they kind of mean by that, to also appeal. So it's not just anybody who participated before the local or state government. The person has to be adversely affected the way this is written. And so if I participated, I'm in the clerk, and I don't want this waiver to be granted, and I file comments with the governmental entity saying, here's why the person didn't meet the qualifications for obtaining a waiver. If I do that, and I can show, and then the government says, well, we're going to grant the waiver anyway, and I can show that I'm adversely affected, I can appeal the government's decision. That way we make sure it gets into court. On the other hand, if somebody else has filed the appeal, I'm going to get notice that the appeal has been filed, and then if I want to continue to participate, because it may be that the claimant is the one who lost, the claimant now files the challenge in court, and I want to be there to make sure that the court upholds the local government's decision in denying the claim. Again, if I can show that I'm adversely affected, I can be there alongside the government in defending the government's decision. Or it may be that I didn't appeal, that one of my other neighbors filed the appeal. Again, if I can show that I'm adversely affected and I participated, then the way this is written, I would have the ability to intervene. So the idea was to allow anybody who participated at the government stage and is adversely affected, could also participate in the judicial review.
I have one last question on Section 8.3. Regarding the process of intervention under ORCP 33, we have sub B, which is intervention as a matter of right, and sub C, which is permissive intervention. No choice is made here in the text as to which you prefer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, as the work group talked about it, we were envisioning this as intervention of right rather than as permissive. And if the person is adversely affected and they participated, then we believed it would be intervention as of right. But you're correct. The way this is drafted, it's not clear.
Thank you. I think later we're going to have to come back and tweak that one.
Okay. Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Under the whole section of judicial review, are these not clarified in statute already? Not specifically, but the flow of, for instance, if we said a circuit court has exclusive jurisdiction except under this one thing, and just left it at that and left the statutes to carry from there, would this not be pretty well covered?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, they eventually would be covered after the court interpreted the statutes to decide what the process should be. Would it be the statutes that govern declaratory judgment? Would it be the statutes that govern writ of review? Would it be the statutes that govern Administrative Procedures Acts for the state? And because it's unclear, we decided it would be helpful to everybody if they didn't have to litigate what is the form of litigation that a Measure 37 claim should take.
Mr. Chair. Is it the committee's desire to take out 8?
Paragraph 8?
What? Is it the committee have an opinion as to whether it wants to take that section, sub 8, out or not?
I think you brought up the question, Representative.
as to whether to leave it in or take it out. If we just want to take something out completely, we can do that now. If we need further discussion on it, then we'll place it on something to do tomorrow.
Well, I would definitely like to take the second sentence in sub 1 out.
Well, I happen to agree with you, Representative. However, we did give Representative Ackerman, I think, the opportunity to get the information from Mr. Klein in that regard. So,
well, that was just in the jurisdiction of the city court. The jurisdictional amounts of where they have adjunctive relief. I probably feel that just take the whole thing out would make it clear. And my reasoning is that folks still have a common law remedy. So it doesn't make any difference if we limit them to a remedy only recognized in circuit court arising out of this administrative ordinance. It seems like it's such a narrow, narrow exception that you're going to get to circuit court anyway in your common law claim. So why restrict jurisdiction in municipal court?
So we're talking about the second sentence in Section 8, starting with the word notwithstanding.
That's right.
And ending with the word entity.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yeah.
Is there anyone on the committee who objects to removing that sentence from Section 8?
Section 8, that's...
Seeing none, that sentence is removed.
Mr. Chair, I have a question on that 8 sub 8 that you were talking about, and I think it may be a more general question. I'm trying to understand this, and for a non-lawyer, this isn't easy. But
we're all struggling with that.
But one. Is the statement a claim for compensation? Does that have to do with only claims for compensation? I mean, I know it's not simple English, but as opposed to claims for compensation as opposed to claims for waiver. Is there anything you're claiming for compensation? Is that what we're having? It looks like there's different treatment for that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, that was a mistake. I'd like to blame it on my computer. What we tried to do is, wherever it said claim for compensation, is change it to say claim.
Okay.
And so for compensation should be deleted from that paragraph. What we're really talking about
is measure 9 and for other places.
Correct.
Well, maybe I do understand English. There's that danger.
You get wiser every day. Okay, Bruce, I guess, well, is there any objection from the committee for taking Section 8, subparagraph 8, out?
Are we doing that?
Just an option to us because it was of controversy. Representative Ackerman.
Well, again, I'm directing this to Mr. Klein, but isn't Section 8 basically the language of scope of review for a writ of review?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, you're correct. There is some unintended overlap between subsection 7 and subsection 8, and we tried to address that actually by making a few tweaks to subsection 7. But section 8 is the provision that says this is based on the record of the entity below, and so we would certainly recommend that the committee leave that in. Otherwise, you're creating this record down below, and then you're allowing people to relitigate and bring in entirely new evidence up above at the circuit court level.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if 7 and 8 can be reconciled or harmonized, maybe council can do that. But I think we have to either let the public know we're proceeding by a writ of review, or we have to write the rules in as to what a writ of review is, because there's several different ways a court can go when they get a file of this nature. If it's a writ of review, they know what channel to go down in terms of the scope of review. If it's another type of remedy, they go someplace else.
Mr. Klein, can you respond to Representative Ackerman's request?
Mr. Chair, absolutely. In fact, what was dropped off with Legislative Council Friday afternoon, I believe, contains the tweak to 7 to try to clarify this.
Once again, you're one step ahead of us, and that's not fair. Okay, Bruce, let's try it again.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would like to state that I agree with Mr. Klein.
I'm sorry, Representative Ackerman.
Yeah, as long as we're making these insertions or excising this stuff out, can we have counsel or someone direct that paragraph 3 would be at least ORCC 33 sub D would be mentioned so that the parties know that this is incidental as a matter of right. That's an easy one, but I'll make sure we get it taken care of. Thank you.
Off again. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I think you better hurry up.
I better get going. I agree with Mr. Klein. 7 and 8, I think, can be harmonized. I don't see the value in eliminating 8 at this point. Just more work on that. Moving to Section 9, subparagraph 3 on page 15.
Section.
I'll let everyone get that.
Section 9.
Section 9, subparagraph 3, page 15.
That's with the word erroneously?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. This is a little bit different from earlier drafts. Earlier drafts had a a standard of review in that section. We had wondered at one point if there was a need for a standard of review for this whole section. And I just point that out just so that you see that there isn't a standard of review there. And I would also point out that I believe that's a policy decision that led to that change in this, but it's something to think about as the courts look at this. This isn't the usual process for circuit court. Circuit court, by and large, they do trials de novo, which means the whole thing comes into them and they start from ground zero and go through the case. This process is more along an APA-type process where they're simply reviewing the underlying record, and sometimes it's valuable to tell the reviewing court what the standard of review is as they look at that. I just raise that as an issue. It's as something to think about as you go through this.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Hey, yeah, I'd like to comment on this particular section. We're talking about now 3, sub 3, right, erroneously.
Mm-hmm.
There are a criteria contained in subsection 7 of section 6. That's a really complicated set of items. They're on the top of page 12, right? Which actually reference a bunch of other criteria in other sections. This seems to me like a bit of a nightmare in terms of its cross-referencing. I the extent to which statutes ought to be made clear and straightforward, this doesn't do it, I think. Is there a way to get these criteria back up or something, or be less specific to talk about applicable criteria in this act? Under there's subsection 5 and 6 of section 5, criteria in section 14 and 18 of this act. There's a whole under subsection 7, there's a whole bunch of other stuff. Does this leave a lot of room for error with all this cross-referencing here, or is it usual?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlit, the reason for the cross-referencing is to be as specific as possible with as few words as possible. It's certainly possible to take all of those criteria from all of those cross-reference sections, and instead of saying erroneously applied the criteria contained in subsection 7 of section 6, to say erroneously applied the following criteria to the evidence in the record, colon, and then list out everything that is included in all those cross-reference sections. As long as the words that are inserted here are identical to the words in the cross-reference sections, then there won't be any problem. It's going to add more words here. This is not unusual where something is cross-referenced back to another section.
But cross-reference is back to another section. I mean, you could simply say applicable criteria contained in this measure.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlit, the lawyers in the work group would resist the language applicable criteria in the measure because it begs the question as to, okay, now, this thing over here, is it an applicable criteria or is it not? And there have been a number of particularly LUBA cases, there are probably some in the Court of Appeals, that talk about, well, is this land use provision, the provision in this land use code, an applicable criterion or is it not? And rather than getting to a debate over whether something is or is not an applicable criterion, we thought it would be good to say, here's what they are, even if it's cross-referenced back.
I would accept that statement then. Acknowledge my naivety, except I picked up those words from your section on the top of page 12, where you use applicable criteria in either section 14 or section 18 of this act. So if that's a bad way to do it, what made it good on the top of 12?
Representative Greenlick, on the top of page 12, we're talking about only section 14 or section 18, and so now we're identifying a particular section of the measure as opposed to all 26 pages of the measure. And again, if the committee would like to be as user-friendly as possible, then it would make sense to change subsection 3 on page 15 to simply list out again all of those applicable criteria. Is it legally necessary? In my opinion, it's not, but there are several more lawyers up here, and you can ask them their opinion.
Well, I'm not sure if I may. My worry is that you are not getting all the criteria in this section that could apply. This is a limitation on what can be used in the criteria that can be used in adjudicating an appeal. And you have certain criteria named. I was wondering if you have in fact included all the criteria that might apply by your naming of this subsection and what follows from it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, I believe I have been working on this with Richard Whitman from the Attorney General's office, Dan Olson from Washington County Counsel's office, as well as John Chandler, Dave Honeycutt, Lane, and so, I mean, we've been trying to make sure that we're as comprehensive and accurate as possible. Could we have missed something? Possibly, but we don't think so, at least with respect to that particular issue.
Representative Anderson.
Representative Greenlick, would it be okay if we move ahead? We've got a lot to do, and I think he's explained pretty much that this just relates back to it. It may be confusing you and me.
My problem, Representative Anderson, is the substantive problem. This pretty significantly narrows the criteria that can be used to adjudicate a case. And I'm willing, I mean, I have some questions with the policy of narrowing it, but I want to make sure at least it's not narrowing it. I want to get on the record that we're not narrowing it to any excluding criteria in this statute that we want to make sure are allowed to be considered in an appeal. That's the only issue that I'm raising.
Director, do you have an opinion on it?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think only to state maybe differently, but in support of what Glenn said, I think that what you've got, if you look at subsection 7 of section 6, those are the fundamental elements of a ballot measure 37 claim. Is it complete? Is there a regulation that was enacted after the owner acquired the title of the property that has reduced the value of the owner's use of the property? Did that result in a reduction in value? And if so, is the regulation nevertheless exempt? Those are the key elements of a Measure 37 claim. And by calling out that list of those elements as they appear just by reference to the section and subsection on page 15, you simply identify, you're saying to the court, did the government that reviewed this claim make the right call under the essential elements of a Measure 37 claim as identified in this act?
At the risk of continuing to act like a lawyer, but I just want to say that we're at the level of the court, of course, making a determination. And unless we get these things straightened out now, this is going to lead to more and more litigation. I realize it's sort of tedious, but you miss a checklist on some of these things and you're going to throw the court into confusion. My next question is that on the top of page 13, where you list the five different factors that the court could get into, looking at the writ of review statute, there's an additional provision that reads, allows the court to make a finding as to whether the order of the administrative agency is or is not supported by substantial evidence in the record. I don't see that criterion here. Was there a reason to take that out?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, what at the top of page 15, the subsection 3 that we were just discussing was substituted for the provision that you just referred to.
Okay.
The reason it was substituted is because the provision in the writ of review statute is a somewhat deferential statute, or a deferential provision that says that the court should defer to the local government, or in this case it would be the local or state government if we use that standard, if there is substantial evidence in the record to support the finding. It's possible that there's substantial evidence in the record to support contrary findings, because that's the nature of the evidence. What this provision was intended to do is say that we aren't going to have the courts defer to the government if substantial evidence in the record can support either of two findings, then the court's going to get to weigh the evidence and make that decision. And again, that was, in terms of the policy issues embedded in here, that was a policy discussion and then decision of the work group to have this provision substituted for the deferential one.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, can you ask another question?
Representative Greenwich?
On Section 9, erroneously applied criteria contained in Subsection 7, included in that criteria in Subsection 7 are two sections of Section 5. There are only Sections 5 and 6. Does that mean that if the claim process is flawed by a violation of Section 1 through 4, the Circuit Court could not deny the claim?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, no, that's not what it means. The subsection 3 at the top of page 15 that's cross-referencing into that is just talking about the applicable criteria. It's not talking about the process. Subsection 2, right above it on page 15, says fail to follow applicable procedures. And that's not
what under your statement before, just so you don't leave it extraneous or variable, are the other claims processing processes, I mean, you have under the claims process, in specifically under 3, items 5 and 6 of Section 5, I think, but then you mean that item 2 above are items 1 through 4 in Section 5? Is that what you mean by fail to follow applicable procedures? Or do you mean something else? I know you don't like to be non-specific.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenwick, what is intended is fail to follow any of the applicable procedures, which could be in Section 5, it could be in Section 6 of this, or if this happens to be in sections 5 or 6. So it would include subsections 1 through 4. It would include subsection 7 of Section 5. It would include Section 8, 9, 10. If there was any failure to follow an applicable procedure, that could be grounds under subsection 2 of Section 9 for the court reversing.
Not the fee, that comes under subsection 3, the $1,000, if they fail to...
Right, that's a requirement of the claimant, when you, as the claimant, apply, you have to provide certain information and you have to pay a fee. And that was included under the sort of the applicable criteria. Did you do those things?
No, that's included under 3.
Right. That's what I mean. Under 3.
Yeah, the wrong is you applied the criteria.
Right. As opposed to the applicable procedures. The applicable procedures is, did the government fail to follow the applicable procedure?
Okay, we're starting to repeat ourselves for the third and fourth times here, so I think that unless other members of the committee agree and want to stay on the subject, that Representative Greenlich and Mr. Klein can maybe get together after the committee or at another time and discuss any changes that the representative would like to see. Okay, just want to move on to Section 10, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Section 10, subparagraph 1, if you look at subparagraph A, it talks about a judgment. If you look at subparagraph B, it talks about a judgment. Subparagraph C, then we talk about an order. And one of the things that Mr. Klein and I discussed was the need in subsection 3 to close the loop, to get a provision in there about a judgment to finalize what happens there, just as we've done in sub A and sub B. And I'll stop for a moment if you have a question on that.
Don't stop. Oh, never mind.
Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize, Mr. Chair.
I wonder why you use the term order rather than judgment in sub C. Seems to me that's still a judgment if it's reversing a final decision.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, there's a whole procedure set out in sub C that I think will be discussed in a few moments that will explain why it is set up that way. If we can just, I just have one other point on this, and we can get through those, and perhaps Mr. Klein will have some other things to say about the judicial review in general. But there is a whole procedure in sub C that allows the government to come in and decide whether to compensate in lieu of waiving and back and forth. He understands the process much better than I do, but I think that's the basic point of C. It might help if I explain the way that I see A, B, and C working. A, the court will affirm if the public entity got it right on compensation, waiver, or the fact that there's a no claim. Subsection B, the court will reverse if the public entity granted either a waiver or a compensation when relief was not due. And then we go to Section C, which sets up the circumstance where perhaps the claim should have been allowed, perhaps the compensation that was awarded needs an adjustment, or perhaps the waiver portion needs some adjustment on what's being waived. That was how I viewed those three sections on how we resolve the claims that come to the court.
Representative Ackerman, did you get your question answered?
Not right now.
Yeah. No, I mean, did you get your question?
Yes, I have no questions.
Oh, okay. Any question? Go ahead.
And then the other point that I wanted to make on Section 10, subparagraph 1, sub C, is that it might be worthwhile, and Mr. Klein and I have discussed this, and I think he's got the wording drafted on it, it might be worthwhile to be specific about whether that order is appealable or not. Some orders are appealable. It may very well be that you don't want appeals going up until a judgment is filed in this, in which case it would be worthwhile to say that the order is not appealable, or something to that effect. And I believe those were the major points that I wanted to highlight for the committee.
Any questions?
Did I understand you to say there was something in sub 3 that you wanted to amend? I think you're talking about C, and you mentioned something in sub 3, I thought.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, it's not coming to mind, but it does bring to mind one other issue that there is here, and that is, I apologize for this, that is on the order.
The first thing that it says,
subparagraph C, and then you go to subparagraph A, the court shall modify the amount of compensation. The problem with that is, after the court orders the modification of compensation, you go into an appraisal process. it's probably not a good idea to have the court awarding compensation when the court doesn't know what the compensation ought to be because you haven't had the appraisal process. The compensation that the court will order presumably will be a number that it picks from the underlying record, but that may not be where any of the parties want to land. And so Mr. Klein's working on wording for that to say that they're not going to set the compensation, but that they'll address the issue, and then you would go into the appraisal process and work your way towards what the compensation should be.
Can I ask another question? Different issue. Mr. Klein, you mentioned the fee, and I had it brought up to me over the weekend that this is like, could be likened to me driving along the road and an automobile in front of me throws up a rock and breaks the windshield, and then I'm being asked to pay a fee to investigate this problem. Is there a real justification for the state to be asking for a fee for this part of the for the claim? Yes, for the land use part later, but for the investigation seems unfair as presented in that way that the claimant or the applicant should be paying a fee at that point.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, this is one of those big picture policy discussions that I would like to defer to Linda Ludwig and Art Schlack to talk about. It's not embedded in these judicial review sections, and so I'm not sure whether you want to talk about it now or you want to talk about it at another time.
Okay. But
just so the committee's clear, if you decide to talk about it another time, it would be on your second round because the place where the fee is back in Section 5 that you've already had your first round through.
Right.
Representative,
you
might make an asterisk there when we go through that portion of it. Gwen, do you have any other comments on Section 10?
Mr. Chair, let me just have one comment on Section 10, which is to respond to the question that Representative Ackerman asked about why in C do we use the word order rather than the word judgment. The reason is that if the court gets to sub C, the court isn't done yet. What the court has said is there is a valid claim, but whatever the government did with respect to that claim was wrong. At that point, what's embedded here is to give the government the next the ball's back in the government's court. The government should take the next step. Does the government want to compensate, or does the government want to go ahead and agree to waive the regulations? Until the government makes that decision, we believe that it would be premature to have any kind of a judgment. What we wanted to do is have the government say, okay, we'll just go ahead and waive the regulations, judge, that you decided should be waived. At that point, the judgment would get entered. Or alternatively, the government would say, we think this is one where we want to compensate. And so the government files notice with the court within 45 days of that order to say, we think we want to compensate here. Now the government gets an appraisal, has 90 days to get the appraisal, gives it to the property owner. The property owner says, yeah, that's the right value, or no, it's not. If the property owner says it's not the right value, the property owner gets an appraisal. Now the two sides get together. If they can agree on a compensation number, that then gets embedded in a judgment. If they can't agree, the court then has an evidentiary hearing, accepts the appraisals, hears from the appraisers, makes a decision, and then at that point, the court would enter judgment. What's missing from here, which is what Mr. Miller pointed out to me, is that after you get through subsection 3, subsection 4 of this, there's no subsection 5 that explicitly says, and now it's time to enter the judgment. Mm-hmm. And so that's something that is in the process of getting added.
Bruce, you have anything else?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm done.
And you are with Section 11.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I have no comments on that.
I'm just asking for it. Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the time.
And Glenn, I'm going to assume that you will be referencing with Mr. Miller as you get ready to draft this, what hopefully will be a final overall amendments to
the entire package.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. What I have said is as soon as we see the whole thing, that we get it hopefully to him and to others before it got distributed to the committee or others, so that we can all say, yeah, we've taken care of all the problems that have been identified.
Hopefully we can have that document from this committee to you tomorrow. That's the intention. So that you have a little bit of time, 2 or 3 hours to review the report.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. More than enough, I'm sure.
Yeah. Committee, we have 20 minutes to back on the floor, and we move to Section 12. Glenn, why don't you go ahead and open that door?
Mr. Chair, Section 12 deals with the use of the waiver, and it has basically two components to it, one in subsection 1, one in subsection 2. Subsection 1 is intended to say that you have your waiver as a property owner and now you want to use it. You are entitled to use it, but you still must comply. When you try to rely on your waiver, you have to comply with whatever that decision says, because the waiver may say it's okay to build your house subject to this constraint and this constraint. So you have to comply with those constraints, and in addition, you have to comply with any land use regulation that wasn't waived. That's what subsection 1 is intended to do. Subsection 2 is intended to deal with a very different issue, and I discussed this, and Blair Honeycutt and I actually both discussed this last week, is to deal with the situation where a property owner has filled out their claim form, has said, what I want to do, let's use a house as an example, I want to build this house. And the government says, okay, you've identified the use, we think you need a waiver of these 5 regulations, and here's your waiver of these 5 regulations. Now the property owner comes back and says, okay, here's my waiver, I want to build the house. And the government says, ooh, it looks like we forgot a regulation. There's the 6th regulation that also prevents you from building that house. And if we had thought about it back then, you would have been entitled to a waiver back then as well. Subsection 2 is intended to say, we're not going to have any kind of these gotchas. Instead, now as the property owner, what you can do is to say, okay, you should have waived it back then. Here's my additional claim for that regulation. If you recall back when we were talking about the claims process, what we had said is you only get, in essence, as a property owner, one bite at the apple for any regulation in effect at the time that you file your claim. This is an exception to that. This is intended to say if we, the government, miss something that we should have mentioned to you, then you get to ask for it now, we can waive it now, and then you can go and build your house. That's what subsection 2 is intended to do.
Why only one additional claim? Suppose the county makes, or the city makes, 2 errors or 3.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, the assumption is that when you come in for now your building permit or your land use application, that at that point we will identify as part of that application all of the criteria. And it may be that we identify 2 or 3 regulations we should have caught, but we will have identified them at the time that you apply for that land use permit or building permit.
Chairman.
Yes.
Yeah, just a minor point. When does this additional claim get filed? Is there another time period, or would it be better to allow them to amend the claim so they can preserve all the other time periods that were implicit in the first claim?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, the assumption is that this happens long after the other claim has been processed and decided. The initial claim is filed. A waiver is granted. If there's any judicial review, that takes place. Now you have your final waiver, and now you come in for your land use application. And then we say, oops, we missed one. This doesn't say that you have to file your claim within 20 days or 60 days or 100 days, and that could certainly be spelled out here as to how much time you would have to file that. The assumption was you would file it almost immediately because, in fact, you're ready to get your building permit, and so you want to process that as quickly as possible.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Anything in Section 13?
Section 13 is transferability. We had a lengthy discussion last week about trying to explain what we intended. And in brief, basically what we have said is that when you get the waiver will be good for a minimum of 10 years. It can transfer one time, 10 times, 0 times, or 100 times within that 10 years, but it can transfer as many times as one can for 10 years. So the waiver is good for at least 10 years. In addition, if the person who obtained the waiver has held on to the property for longer than that 10-year period, that individual will be able to transfer it, transfer the waiver once. And the person who obtains the waiver at that point, let's say that the waiver is transferred after I, as the claimant, have had the waiver for 20 years, I transfer it. The person I transfer it to will be able to use it within a 2-year period. That's what subsection 1 is intended to do. Subsection 2 then goes on to say, and if I, as the person who holds the waiver, takes advantage of it, if I substantially implement it, if I...
Chair, can I ask a question?
Subsection 1,
yeah. It doesn't seem to say what you just said it says.
Mm-hmm.
Can we run by that again? What it says is, the waiver expires the later of 10 years after the date of the final decision?
Right. Or 2 years after the owner...
Or if I'm going to transfer sometime, it could be 50 years after the date of the final decision?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ringman, that's correct. That's what sub 2 is. It's the later of. So I get the waiver on January 1, 2006. Sub A says I have... that it can be transferred as many times as one wants to transfer it between January 1, 2006.
Where did you see that?
The later of 10 years after the date of the decision.
So I get the decision in 2006. You're saying it does not expire in 2016?
It would not expire in 2016 if you were the person who obtained the waiver. Because you still own the property. Because paragraph B says, you, as the person who obtained the waiver, the owner who obtained the waiver, can transfer it, and it will be good for until 2 years after you have transferred it. So if you transferred in 2050, and you were the person who obtained, you were the owner who obtained the waiver, it would be good until 2052.
You're saying that essentially what these rules should say is the waiver is permanent for the person who obtained it, does not expire for the person who obtains it, unless the property is transferred, at which case it expires in 2 years?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ringman, that would be correct.
Can that be clarified?
Boy, that's very different than these words.
We will work with legislative counsel to try to clarify it, because I understand that lots of people have read this section and have not understood what we intended. So we will work on trying to clarify it.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mellon.
I actually think that the words say what you've described here, but I have a real concern about what that does, for example, to adjacent properties. If I own a piece of property and I get a waiver that says I can build a meatpacking facility on it, as long as I own that property, all the adjacent property owners are at risk that someday I'll cash in my chit and build the meatpacking facility. They never get certainty of what their neighbor is going to be doing.
Can I add something? Having gone through a meatpacking, actually a slaughter, a pig slaughterhouse in my district, we went through that very system. And the part we're omitting in the process is your local government. A slaughterhouse is considered okay for EFU land, which is what we ran into, but there are lots of other problems associated with that particular scenario. But I'm wondering if we should trust local government to make that decision.
Because they have to go through that process.
But Mr. Chair, local government doesn't have a say. If the property was in my family before there was any zoning or before there was anything that would restrict, whether it's a packing house or a nightclub or whatever might be considered a less than attractive neighbor, and that depends on what the adjacent property use is, because in some areas a slaughterhouse would be a welcome neighbor, but in some it wouldn't. But my point is that it creates indeterminate, not quite permanent, but certainly extensive uncertainty for all the adjacent property holders. That has to have a very, very dampening effect on that whole neighborhood.
I would add that if that property owner wanted to put that type of facility, and we were talking about anything that's zoned all the way from EFU on down, it's permissible today. They wouldn't need a Measure 37 claim to do that. But they still would have to go through the local process. And therefore, believe me, that would not be easy, because that's when the adjacent property owners would have the opportunity to stop whatever was going on that land. I'm just... Director Shetterman.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to help this discussion, perhaps, I think maybe the concern Representative Nolan has is if you have neighboring property owners who have bought, let's say, in recent past under current zoning where a use may not be permitted, they would have bought on the expectation that certain uses would not be permitted in the vicinity of where they're located, and now under a Measure 37 claim, a use that would have been allowed several years before will now become reauthorized again. That's just a function of Measure 37. I don't think there's anything that we're going to do about that. This bill doesn't fix that, because that exists under the bill.
Would not those adjacent property owners then have a 37 claim?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe they would not, because the impact on their property has not been by any regulation imposed by local government. It's been by the exercise of another property owner of the use of the property. And Measure 37 is triggered by a government regulation that restricts the use of property. So I don't think it's anticipated under this bill or even under current Measure 37 as it stands that the use of property by a property owner who is permitted under a Measure 37 claim would that causes some impact on neighboring property owners would give rise by those neighboring property owners to a claim against the government for that impact.
Okay. Representative Green.
Yeah, we have a flat-out policy decision. I think there's a wording problem buried in the middle of the policy decision, but we really do want to make clear, I mean, this is the huge issue is how we're deciding on transferability. And if we're talking about wording, I would feel much more comfortable with the sooner of rather than with the later of, which is also a policy decision rather than...
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenberg, it is. Representative Noe, I wanted to touch on this too. The policy consideration here is if we're going to transferability, if you limit the term within which the waiver must be exercised, essentially what you were doing is accelerating this development, which may not be the best. I mean, that's the kind of trade-offs you're looking at. If you're going to say that the waiver has to be used for all purposes within 5 years from the date that it's issued, then you are putting somebody in a position probably of having to exercise a waiver, maybe build that rendering plant or whatever the case might be. Perhaps years, decades before they might otherwise ever get around to building it. By allowing the waiver to extend for the term of the original owner's use, you're allowing that owner to forestall the actual development of that use, and circumstances could change that might make it infeasible for some other reason. So those are the trade-offs. The shorter term you apply on the validity of the waiver, the more pressure you're putting on actually causing the development to occur.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Throughout this whole section 13, it may be very clear to a legal mind, but I'm not so sure it is to the general public, as to whether this really passes muster for the banks to loan indefinitely on that property. Is there any way that that can also be clarified so that it can be stated that this claim is, this waiver is good? I see that. And that it's good when substantially implemented, but is there any term that can be used to make it very clear that this is just like it would have been in 1968 or 72?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, we tried to do that by adding subsection 3 at the top of page 17, which the lawyer technicians among us sort of argued about, well, you know, this really is superfluous because it's already covered by 1 and 2, but for that very reason, to try to make it clear as possible that, yes, that's what it's doing, we put into subsection 3.
The validity of the waiver?
Right.
Okay.
And one of the other things we can do, and see if we can get the information back to the committee, is to try to get this language to some of the lawyers for the lending institutions to say, you know, if this goes through, is that going to resolve some of your concerns? I don't know that we'll be able to do that by tomorrow, but we'll try to get that done for you.
We can see if we can have someone from the financial institutions here at this committee meeting tomorrow. Sam, would you take that up? Representative Ackerman. Representative?
Yes, I just have two quick questions.
You can make them quick, because we do need to get to the floor.
Yeah,
look, be quick.
Top of 17, sub B, where it says, for all other users, the use specified in the waiver has vested. So what do you refer to?
This sort of comes to the point, if you have the waiver, it's vested already, why this language? Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, that's a term of art. There are a number of court cases, the most famous of which I think is Clackamas County v. Holmes, that talk about when a use has vested. And I can certainly get you, I think I have a memo somewhere in a file that says, here's how that plays out. But that's what it's intended to do, is tie back into the court cases that talk about when a use is vested.
Why not just specify that the waiver is vested after a final decision of either the administrative body or the court?
Mr. Chair,
that'd be the rule anyway.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, that's not the rule in the courts, and it's going to be a longer conversation than I think we have right now, so perhaps later.
My second question is very quick, and I think it's a good idea that we record the waivers, but I'm wondering about the formulation of a standardized form, either by putting it in the statute or subjecting it to rulemaking process.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, that sub 4 actually has been moved in the version that I think is going to be coming out of Legislative Council to another section, and I believe what the language is, it talks about either a copy of or a memorandum of the waiver gets recorded. So we're trying to tie it back to more traditional language.
Yeah, I'm wondering if this be a simpler document in the form of a memorandum outlining the basic points, one page, rather than putting in a 30-page document for recording at the courthouse.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, that's what others have suggested, and that's why the language is being tweaked.
Okay, thank you.
Bob, can you hold your thought till tomorrow morning?
I certainly will, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Committee, we will pick up right at this point tomorrow morning at 8:30. For Monday, June 13th, we are adjourned.